Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. On this Labor Day weekend, we will begin with the contrasting narratives for working Americans emerging from the presidential primaries underway, with the billionaire Donald Trump promising miracles with motivational self-help promises, while Bernie Sanders calls for social justice and the leveling of the playing field between overwhelming corporate and political power and weakened labor unions and the downsized middle and working classes. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, joins us to discuss the rise of populism on the left and right and discuss the chances of the Republican establishment's success as it gangs up to stop the Trump steamroller, as well as possible wildcards upsetting the Democratic primaries. Then we'll cover the ouster of Guatemala's president who went straight from the palace to prison just ahead of today's elections that many wanted delayed so that a wider range of candidates could run in a race dominated by representatives of the old guard who are mired in corruption with most of Guatemala's former presidents either in exile or jail. A cultural anthropologist who has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala, Victoria Sanford, the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies at City University New York, joins us to discuss the role of people power in ousting a corrupt leader. Then finally, we'll go to Moscow to look into reports likely leaked by the Russians that Putin is planning to bolster the embattled Assad regime in Syria with increased military aid and possible ground troops and combat aircraft. A Moscow-based independent defense analyst, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a columnist for Novaya Gazeta, joins us to discuss the likelihood that Putin is trying to leverage his earlier proposals to have the West and its Arab allies join Russia in the fight against ISIS by threatening to escalate Russian involvement unless they accept his plan, which envisions the Assad family staying in power. And joining me now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington-based editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Steve, just to touch on the number of wide range of subjects that I'd like to discuss with you today, starting out with these competing or contrasting narratives on this Labor Day weekend, do you accept the premise that we have a sort of right-wing populist and a left-wing populist who are certainly getting all the headlines with Trump ahead in the race? I guess the contrast would be between these two, certainly in religious terms, would be Bernie Sanders representing liberation theology and Donald Trump representing the prosperity gospel.
That's a very interesting comparison. I mean, certainly you have pulsating through the country just a real rejection of institutional politicians, you know, professional politicians and people who've been out there. They see Bernie Sanders as reflecting a very different kind of representation. And of course, Donald Trump is blowing everybody's minds with, you know, his success and this kind of gravity-less popularity he has among the GOP for some things. And you know, he's not even really in line with kind of right-wing conservatives on every issue, but the pugnaciousness that he brings to this is something very appealing, and I think it's just the most I've seen out there in both parties just wanting to reject corporate Washington, and you see it going on in both sides of the aisle.
Well, of course, a precedent was back in 1980 when a divorced Hollywood actor, Ronald Reagan, captured the hearts and minds of evangelicals over a very devout Baptist preacher, in effect, who taught Sunday school.
Well, I mean, he did, but Ronald Reagan, you know, in economic terms, also captured the aspirations and interests of a lot of white working class Democrats who felt abandoned by their party. So I don't think about these candidates in theological terms. I do think about how they respond to what usually is the most important issue to most voting Americans, and that's the economy. And so when you look at that, both of these guys reject essentially the status quo and how we were doing business. You know, Donald Trump may make that sort of harder there, but he is now still aspiring, you know, still attracting those white working class angry Reagan Democrats, and that's because he thinks that they think that his pathway, his unusual, unorthodox way to riches is something that they aspire to be. But Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, is essentially like where Elizabeth Warren very much is, and saying there's a corruption of interests in Washington, and he's standing against that. So that's where they come together, I think.
But in terms of the GOP establishment ganging up to stop Trump, there was a report in the New York Times that they were all sort of having heartburn, and all of these big donors were constantly conferring with the other candidates who are running against him, who seem to be dead in the water, except perhaps for Ted Cruz, who seems to be allied with Donald Trump. So what's going on there? On the one hand, one would think that the Republicans would, you know, they rely on getting Democratic votes. They are not the majority party. So having a right-wing populist who's going to get the Reagan Democrats out to vote is a plus for them. But on the other hand, clearly Donald Trump is a bit of a nightmare for them as well.
He's a total nightmare for them. You have a struggle for the soul of the Republican Party playing out in live action in front of us, and it's very strange. I remember after the last election in which Barack Obama beat Mitt Romney, and a lot of people thought Romney was going to win, particularly Romney himself, but some of those who didn't, and I saw them right after the race, were John McCain and Lindsey Graham, you know, who said, "Steve, you know, it's one thing to be, you know, killed or knocked off the tracks by a fast-moving train. It's another thing when it's a slow-moving truck." And the slow-moving truck to them was the issue of immigration. And they said, "We are alienating ourselves as Republicans from Hispanics in America." Now here comes Donald Trump, and he doubles down, triples down on that, and that really, really appeals to some element of the most jingoistic and most nativist nationalists in America, who resent immigration, resent the immigrants in the country, and he's basically, when you had people like Jeb Bush and what I would call the sort of reasonable, semi-moderate Republicans trying to essentially open that door in a more embracing way of a smarter immigration policy for the country, you know, Trump went exactly the different direction. So he's causing a nightmare for the Republican Party. And on top of that, they didn't take him seriously. I mean, they all thought he was a temporary joke. They thought this was a replay of the election 4 years ago, in which you had a new candidate pop up, you know, and steal the limelight. Every 2 weeks they would be up, and then they would fall, and then you'd be another one that fall. And it was kind of this, you know, whack-a-mole thing. He's showing resilience. He's showing he has legs, and he's turned himself into a, you know, one-man media machine. So for the GOP, he really is a nightmare, because he's an ideologue, and what he represents, and particularly his battle with Fox News, has been fascinating, because nobody thought you could have a battle with Fox News and run as strongly as he is politically. He is showing that he can be bigger than all of them, and I think he's got them scared to death.
And again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. So given this miscalculation or this surprise, and it's true that Trump is brilliant at playing the media, all these other guys are raising all this money to buy airtime through their PACs and their 501c4s, and Trump's getting all this free media. He's putting
constantly.
It must be making them crazy. But why, on the other side, you know, you've got Bernie Sanders. He has a brilliantly simple piece, op-ed in Sunday's LA Times, which is just a series of charts and graphs of contrasting CEO pay to average medium workers' pay, the national employment rate, percentage of the entire wealth of the United States owned by the top 1%, and so on. And it's extremely arresting and very, very, I think, brilliantly simple. On the other hand, all you're getting from Trump is hollow slogans and almost motivational talk. It's almost like, you know, the billionaire's fairy dust is going to rub up off on you. So at what point is there going to be some specifics here?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, it's going to be up to Trump when he's there. I assume that as the field narrows, as others drop out, hopefully the pressure on him to bring some detail and specificity to what he's talking about will increase. You know, he was on the radio the other day with Hugh Hewitt and didn't do so well with some of the basic. I mean, I wouldn't say that Hewitt's questions were, you know, extraordinarily difficult, but when it came to foreign policy, Trump's basic understanding seemed to be pretty thin. But again, that seems not to have mattered at all to those that are following him and think it's important. What Bernie Sanders is doing, however, is unbelievably important. Bernie Sanders, the things he's raising now are not new. When I worked for Senator Jeff Bingaman in the 1990s, we were looking at all these issues. You know, the giant gap, you know, gaps between CEO pay and the least paid in a company. Looking at how people were being asked to acquiesce to a turbocharged economy where their jobs would change a lot if they could get jobs, but they couldn't move their pensions at that time. They couldn't move their education benefits. You know, the system was stacked up against workers and working families in extraordinary ways. You had the issue we talked about, the Tobin tax, of trying to take, you know, link the negative effects of short-term stock behaviors and say, well, if people want to trade stocks and equities like that, which has such a deleterious effect on investment, maybe we could link that churning, tax it at some modest degree, and then use that to fund educational benefits and broader science and technology investment. We did all that in the 1990s during the Clinton administration, which completely ignored us. Bill Clinton ignored us. I mean, everybody out there was in this kind of gaga economy that everything was, you know, was going to be fine and okay, and you didn't need to look at these deep structural problems. So what Bernie's doing, for some reason, people now get it. When they look and sort of see that you've had this growth in the economy, but we've lost and not replaced. People talk about the growth rate and the jobs have been created. There have been more than 1 million jobs, good, well-paying jobs that have not come back after the recession. Most of the jobs that have come back, when they talk about aggregate job numbers, on the lower end of the pay scale. And people are getting it that this recovery is not helping them recover. And so Sanders has finally found that sweet spot and bringing up some of these structural, you know, information and, you know, the data and the charts, and people are finally listening. I think it's extraordinary.
So why isn't Hillary Clinton doing this?
Well, one wonders. I think in part, Hillary Clinton doesn't have, how do I put it, an authentic and real understanding of what's going on at that level. She talks about it now and then, but I got to tell you how disappointed I was in her when, you know, when her husband ran, he was out at barbecues and hanging out with regular people, poor people, working families, people that were having a tough time. Hillary Clinton took a couple of weeks off and go spend $100,000 a month on a Hamptons retreat. It's just a very different sensibility. I remember when Ann Richards, the governor, former governor of Texas, was you know, out hitting the stump for Bill Clinton in that time, and basically said that George H.W. Bush had been born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And this took, you know, went wildfire, went viral. Well, you could say the same thing right now about Hillary Clinton, not being born with it, but that's the way she's behaving. And so she's not coming from the same place. And I think it's a huge, huge mistake on her part. I don't know why they're choosing to do this, but they seem to be doing this all over. They're very good on women's issues. They're very poor in the broad economy. And when you've got people that have been such, you know, important parts of the Clinton franchise, like Larry Summers and others who were in part, you know, leading the deregulation of the economy, setting a lot of the environmental factors that, you know, helped create the conditions for the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Those big money participants, you know, of kind of ultra neoliberal financial houses are part of the Clinton franchise, and I think it makes it constrains her ability to be authentic in talking about the problems of working families.
And Steve Clements, you know Vice President Biden, and he's obviously really deep in grief over what losing a son. There's nothing worse than a parent losing a child. And of course, he had earlier tragedies, losing his wife and child as well. So all this talk about him running, he did try to at least address his grief the other day in Atlanta. But as an objective observer, I would say that if Vice President Biden enters the race, it's really going to hurt the Democrats, even no matter how you slice it. What's your opinion?
I think it, you know, my view is I have a lot of respect for Joe Biden. I think that he does bring an authenticity to these issues of working family. I also think he's very good in foreign policy. He has gone through this enormous family crisis, and I don't think he should run if he's still wounded with that. In fact, I tweeted that out the other day, sort of a note to him where I said, I put a picture of the vice president being sworn in when he won in the, his first election in the House of Representatives. And, you know, his wife and daughter had been killed, and he was in the hospital, was sworn in with Beau Biden, who was just a few years old, in the bed next to him. And I said, remember, you know, your energy and spirit back then, you've got to muster that up, because if you're going to run wounded, it won't work. But I think that if Joe Biden enters the race, it's not a natural win. There's a point where you have to ask yourself, can Bernie Sanders see this through? Can he structurally raise the money? You can ask the same things about Joe Biden. You know, is Bernie Sanders really, is his support really all about him? Or is it a placeholder for, a Biden or an Elizabeth Warren or some other concoction that could come in? I don't know the answer to that. I think it would diversify significantly and create factions, further deepening of factions within the Democratic Party, because there clearly are two, at least right now, if not more, between where Hillary Clinton is and Bernie. But if Biden enters, my instinct is it'll be good for democracy and maybe bad for the Democrats. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's one of these weird things that we're coming up on an election, and you look at both parties, and they're incredibly in incredible disarray on both sides. So Biden throwing his hat in the ring is not necessarily going to, you know, make the disarray greater necessarily. It's already there. And people clearly are struggling with this notion of having, you know, a potential election between the brother of a president and the wife of a president. And it feels very rotten to many people. And so they're looking for something else.
But just in closing, wouldn't it deepen the sense that there's something wrong with Hillary Clinton? If Joe,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that the Biden people think that. I mean, you know, when you have someone really thinking about president and running, and they almost can't help but run. And I am sure, with the respect that they say is between them, Biden at his core believes he is more qualified and would be a better leader than Hillary Clinton. That she doesn't have the spark, the creativity, that special ingredient, that secret sauce that it takes to be president. I've talked to a number of top Biden people, and that's just their view. With Biden gaffes and all, you know, he has enormous respect for President Bill Clinton. He has enormous respect for Obama. There's a secret sauce that goes into what they think is the spark of being able to lead the nation. And they don't believe that she has that. And I'm not going to argue whether he's right or wrong, but if you really feel that deeply, and he has gone through this Beau Biden shock, it's very hard for him not to run. That's where he is right now, and he's struggling with that.
Well, Steve Clemens, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate
it. My pleasure, Ian. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. And likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a Senior Fellow and Founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, he served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the ouster of Guatemala's president, who went straight from the palace to prison. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Sanford.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And more than 7.5 million Guatemalans over 18 are eligible to vote in today's presidential elections. But my understanding is that a lot of people are talking about boycotting the election, or they're certainly not enthused by the election, that they wanted postponed so that there could be more variety amongst the candidates. And there's a sense that this the two that are likely to be in the runoff are not exactly a fresh start from the old guard that is so incredibly entrenched and so incredibly corrupt.
That is correct in a nutshell. It's estimated that 30% of voters will abstain. It's unclear if they will vote nulo. Nulo is going in and marking your ballot, no vote, because there's a movement to mark it no vote. But this takes place within the context of a country where the electoral system has been holding elections since the military dictatorship still existed before the peace accords were signed in 1996. This is the 30 years of elections right now. And they just have basically had a democratic revolution in the country where they pushed, the citizens organized, and there was civil society participation and rule of law, which are two critical parts of democracy, and they trumped a corrupt electoral system. And the president, Otto Perez Molina, was forced to resign, and he's sitting in jail today for corrupt charges, as is his former vice president. And so the election takes place in the face of a huge victory for citizens in that country and a great disgust for a political system, an electoral system that is basically purchased. Whoever has the most money tends to win. And this is happening in the context of a country where the majority of first-time voters are 18 to 25 years old. So they weren't alive during the genocide. And one out of every five voters is illiterate.
So in terms of the two that are likely to win in this or to go to this next runoff, center-right businessman Manuel Baldizón and the comic actor Jimmy Morales, he's supposed to be a centrist, but my understanding is his most of his views are pretty reactionary, aren't they? He's very violently anti-abortion, et cetera.
Well, and he also has been criticized because he does blackface skits. But more importantly, he's allied with the Military Veterans Association, So although his campaign slogan is not corrupt, not a thief, he actually has deep military ties, and he's backed by the military. And that's the same military that says there was no genocide, which Fernández Molina represented, who also said there was no corruption, right? But they're corrupt and they're authoritarian. And Manuel Valdizón, the other candidate, is a conservative businessman, and his vice presidential running mate is accused of criminal association and influence trafficking. He hasn't been charged, but a lot of people believe that he will shortly be charged. But I also think that Sandra Torres is in third place in the polls, and it's not clear which two of these three will end up as the final candidate.
Well, Sandra Torres is the ex-wife of the former president, right? And she's the only sort of leftist candidate there, right? Where would you put her on the left-wing spectrum?
I would put her in the center left. I mean, I think, you know, what's left in what's described as left in Guatemala, when you have a military regime, if you say you believe in education for the poor, you're considered subversive and a leftist. So I would say that she's center left, but not very much left of center. What I'm not clear about, and I don't think anyone really is ultimately like what the percentage of women voting in the elections in Guatemala will be. And when push comes to shove, when they go into that voting booth and they look at Valdizón and they look at Morales, how many of them might just vote for Torres? I don't think we really know.
So Valdizón, who is he's quite religious, isn't he? Fervently so, I'm told.
Very, yes.
Is he Opus Dei or something like that?
I don't think that he's Opus Dei, actually, but I'm not sure.
But he's not belonging to the evangelical church like the former Rios Montt, the general, who's on corruption charges. I mean, on genocide charges.
But what Valdizón does belong to is this club of rich people who believe that if you're the second runner-up in one election, you get to win the next election because it's all based on name recognition and having a lot of money. And there have been a lot of questions over the years about where his resources come from, what are his ties to trafficking, because he's very powerful in the Petén region, which is an area where there's a lot of drug trafficking, human trafficking, money laundering, and you know, exactly what the sources of all his resources are not clear.
And his vice president that you mentioned, Edgar Bakin, he's accused of criminal association and influence trafficking by a powerful United Nations-backed anti-graft commission. They haven't dropped the hammer on him, but there's certainly a lot of smoke, so there's presumably some fire there. When you mentioned, Victoria Sanford, the issue of drugs and the likely ties to this conservative businessman running in this election today in Guatemala, I've heard that from State Department and intelligence people for the longest time. They've described Guatemala as a narco-democracy.
Well, absolutely. If you look at the DEA, the Department, the Drug Enforcement Agency's estimates of Colombian cocaine moving through Guatemala, they estimate that 85% of it physically crosses the land of Guatemala in its travel to get here. And Edgar Bardaquin, he was the former central bank chief. So if he's accused of criminal association and influence trafficking by CICIG, I'm not guessing that his trafficking or criminal association is with banana growers, right? I mean, I don't know what those associations are. But given the corruption charges that have just brought down the government of Pérez Molina and have Pérez Molina and Roxana Baldetti both in jail today, and looking at this Edgar Bardaquin as the former central bank chief and knowing that CICIG has accused him of these kinds of associations, it doesn't bode well for Baldizón.
And again, I'm speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers within Guatemala, Colombia, and South Africa. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College, City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. So given the grip of the narcos over the state, And the prevailing view on the American left is that the U.S. basically is only interested in supporting corrupt, powerful oligarchs. And they've, of course, the history going back to the 1956 coup engineered by the CIA against a popular leader there on trumped-up charges that he was getting weapons from, I think it was from the Czechoslovakia at the time in the Eastern Bloc. It was obviously he was set up. So there's a prevailing view that the U.S. has no interest in democracy. But surely with people like the DEA involved, I can't imagine that anybody in the U.S. government thinks it's in America's interest to have any more of these fronts for these narcos running Guatemala. What's your opinion?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the question really is, what are the next steps in the future? And while the elections today are garnering an awful lot of attention, I think if we look at the deep corruption that's been uncovered and the work that needs to be done around it, the real question for the U.S. role is, what is the U.S. going to do next? What role can the U.S. play in addressing the issue? And the issue is around assets, right? Where did all this money go? These are millions and millions of dollars that were gained through graft and corruption and money that was taken from the government that should have gone for government services. So where is that money? And I think that's the place where the U.S. can play a positive role, because the United States has a squad for international corruption investigation in the FBI, and they've actually been quite successful in some African nations doing investigations in kleptocratic governments, right? Kleptocracy, the kleptomaniacs running the country who take all the resources for themselves. If that money is in dollars, then the U.S. has the capacity to investigate, identify, and return those assets to the country. And I think that's one really positive role that we can play. And I think that there has to be a focus on the assets, because these guys always think they're going to get away with it. They think, okay, well, I'll sit in jail for 3 years or 5 years, and then I'll get off and I'll go off with my millions of dollars. Well, hello, they shouldn't be able to do that.
So in terms of the work that you've done, having spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala, the Victoria Sanford, you mentioned that the military there still denies its role in the genocide, and most of these candidates, at least two of them, we've talked about their ties to the military. What's the sense then of if you've got this spontaneous outbreak of people power, which brought down this corrupt leader, and he went straight from the palace to the prison? And of course, we've had similar manifestations of people power, for example, all over the world, in Malaysia and also in Lebanon, where the You Stink movement has
right.
sprung up as a result
right.
of piles of garbage. So, you know, there's a lot of people around the world, including here in the United States, with these left-wing and right-wing populists like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump doing so well in the primaries. There's clearly a sense of disgust that a lot of people around the world feel about their governments. In the case of Guatemala, do you think this is this new sort of democratic spring, is it likely to lead to some justice long delayed in terms of genocide?
I think that it will, and I think that there's an arc of justice that we can see in Latin America, and that arc of justice is one in which this case fits. And that's where you have these military generals, from Pinochet in Chile to Videla in Argentina to Perez Molina and Rios Montt in Guatemala. And these are people who the U.S. government in the 1980s, Gene Kirkpatrick, said, oh, bureaucratic authoritarianism, they might be tough, but they're our guys and they're honest. You know, they're not honest. Murderers, torturers, mass killers are dishonest, bad people. And if we don't catch them for the genocide and human rights cases, because it takes so long to prove it, ultimately they trip themselves up because they're so corrupt and greedy. And that's what happened with Perez Molina. But it also opens the possibility for more prosecutions on genocide and human rights. And I think those cases will get processed. You know, Videla is sitting in jail today for trafficking children in illegal adoptions, not for killing thousands of people. But one way or another, I do believe that they're going to go to jail. And I think this bodes very well for the future, especially because the mandate of CICIG, which can't address past issues of violence, it's for current issues of corruption and impunity. But their mandate continues on. Their mandate was just renewed. So the work of CICIG isn't done. It's just starting again, and it's starting with a bang. Iván Velásquez brought down Uribe in Colombia, and he just brought down Pérez Molina in Guatemala. He's incredibly brave and a brilliant prosecutor.
So, Vidalis, former general, you say, is involved in child trafficking?
In Argentina.
In Argentina,
right,
sorry.
Vidalis was the head of the military regime in Argentina, mm-hmm. and he was the one who oversaw the disappearance, kidnapping, and torture of thousands of his citizens. And ultimately, what the conviction was for, where the evidence was strong, and also it's a place where there is no statute of limitation on the stealing of children, right? Like, that case never ends. And so that was why they were able to prosecute him, because evidence was brought forward from the grandmothers of the disappeared, where you could connect children by DNA, that they had been kidnapped and trafficked. And that's what he's sitting in jail for today.
And the generals in Guatemala, though, their murder was on a huge scale, even greater than the disappeared in Argentina.
Oh, absolutely. And the numbers in Guatemala, 200,000 people dead, 626 villages burned to the ground, 50,000 people disappeared. And those numbers, if you put all the southern cone together, it doesn't reach that number. The military in Guatemala was they committed genocide. And that at the end of the day, that's 200,000 people out of a population of about 8.7 million at the time. It's absolutely astonishing.
And you feel that at the end of the day, there's likely to be some movement now that we've seen some manifestation of democratic pushback, even if the elections are not should have been delayed and they should have had more candidates.
Absolutely, because the elections not being delayed doesn't mean that the prosecutor's office can't continue to move forward on human rights cases. And all of the exhumations that have been done, and there are several hundred that have been done at massacre sites, all those cases are in the courts in Guatemala. There are a number of cases of disappearances, torture cases, land thieving, massive rape cases of women by military in different rural parts of Guatemala. And all of those cases are slowly moving through the Guatemalan legal system. They're also in the regional system, in the Inter-American system, either at the commission or moving in the Inter-American court. And then there are also cases that continue in international courts, like the genocide case in Spain. And it's really, I think, the strength, it's not which of these is most effective. The strength is that they're in all of those places at the same time. So when a case finally moves in Guatemala, for example, Rios Montt wasn't able to leave the country because if he left, he would have been arrested and extradited to Spain.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Victoria Sanford.
Thank you so much, Ian. Have a lovely day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with cultural anthropologist Victoria Sanford, who studies human rights, international humanitarian law, the anthropology of genocide, race and gender in the Americas, and child soldiers. She is the director of the Center for Human Rights and Peace Studies based at Lehman College City University, New York, and has spent years uncovering evidence of genocide in Guatemala. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Moscow for an update on whether Putin is going to escalate Soviet troops and aircraft into Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences from 1994 to 2005. Felgenhauer published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Thank you.
And Dr. Felgenhauer, what's your reading on the possibility of greater deployment of Russian military assets in Syria? It certainly has a lot of commentators here in the United States alarmed and Pentagon officials. But Russia's had a very long presence in Syria, has it not?
Russian advisors and Russian troops have been in Syria for decades, and this mission never closed down. There was always a presence, though it's, of course, now much reduced compared to the Cold War period. In the mid-80s, there was up to 9,000 combat Soviet Russian troops deployed in Syria, and they were actually involved in combat in Syria and in Lebanon, and there were losses. Tens of officers were killed, hundreds wounded. Actually, three generals were killed in action in Syria and Lebanon in the 80s, fighting the Israelis, of course. So this mission continues. Right now, their advisors, their technical specialists, Russia is supplying the Syrian regime with arms, munitions, spare parts, and, of course, their Russian specialists helping the Syrians to keep their planes flying and bombing and keep their helicopters flying and bombing and in general helping. And also there are combat troops there. There's the Russian port naval facility in Tartus with several hundred naval personnel. And there's a marine deployment there, apparently a company, to guard the Russian garrison, though it's in a more or less peaceful part of Syria, Tartus. That's the up to now rather peaceful coastal province, mostly inhabited by the Alawite sect in Syria, which are the power base of the Assad regime. So we are there. We're supplying Assad. But these are about most likely their numbers of the Russian personnel. There are in the hundreds. There's also a possibility that there are contractors. I mean, sort of kind of mercenaries. Those who Russia would deny are in active service, but there are also military people and specialists also helping the Assad regime. But again, their number right now is less than 1,000 as far as I can know.
Well, the concern, I understand, is that there's an air base at Latakia, which is obviously in the Alawite homeland. And my understanding is that Assad is running out of Alawite recruits, and that's why he's suffering military reverses, and he's lost control of 85% of his country. The concern is that Russia is preparing either to do one of two things, either to deploy combat aircraft at the airfield in Latakia or to boost the personnel at Latakia in order to have more resupply of military equipment via air. Which of those two possibilities do you think is the likely one?
Up to now, I didn't hear about actual combat deployment of Russian military, officially Air Force planes in Syria in combat roles. Of course, the transport planes do fly there, including military transport planes, and there are, again, Russian personnel on the ground. I believe that this there is actually a possibility of further deployment of Russian personnel. I would be surprised if any Russian kind of active service soldiers would be sent directly into combat, into offensive operations. But the deployment of Russian bombers and maybe fighters to provide more accurate air support is possible, and there could be a deployment, additional deployment of combat troops
to secure the Russian bases from ground, air bases from ground attack. It should be understood that, of course, this is all part of a rather bigger Russian strategy in the area. Last month, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov put forward the so-called Putin plan to form a very broad-based coalition against the ISIS, including Russia, Western nations, Arab nations, and also the Syrian regime of Assad, joining forces, and of course the Iranians and the Hezbollah, everyone joining forces against ISIS. This plan did not got a cold shoulder from Arab and Western nations, since it obviously was intended to secure the further existence of the Assad regime, which the West and many Arab nations want to topple. So now it's possible that these rumors of a serious Russian deployment were deliberately leaked by the Russian authorities to put more pressure on the West and on the Arab nations to kind of take on and agree to the Russian plan, that Russia is ready to act as an ally against ISIS if there's an agreement, or if there isn't, Russian forces will appear in Syria anyway, and this could shift, the balance of power in the region, and there could be actually possible clashes between, say, Russian fighters and American fighters over Syrian territory and Syrian airspace. It's clear that Russia wants to have this coalition. It wants to. ISIS is a good target for everyone to unite, and as a side play, Russia could secure the Assad regime, and maybe even further. This is part of trying to kind of form a division of interests with the United States and the West. If Russia is helping against Assad, if we're kind of, Russia is, of course, helping against ISIS, and we're kind of allies, then the West and the United States should ease or fully recall anti-Russian sanctions over Ukraine, and maybe actually recognize that Ukraine is part of the Russian sphere of interest. So here we cooperate, but then you allow us to do what we wish with Ukraine.
And again,
if you don't, then there's going to be problems, because then we're not going to cooperate with your fight on ISIS, and actually maybe we'll be actually making a lot of trouble there.
So far, President Vladimir Putin has only said in relation to this deployment, or the possible deployment of enhanced Russian forces in Syria, that this talk is premature, but he's not ruling it out. You're suggesting that maybe he's playing a bit of a game here to, in effect...
Yes, sure. Because right now, possibility of any serious flare-up in the Ukraine and the Donbass has been diminished. Weather reasons, seasonal reasons, and many other reasons. It's postponed any possibility of serious escalation has been postponed. Now, Syria is moving to the forefront, becoming a very hot potato. And Putin has said, more or less, that we are not yet deploying larger numbers of Russian troops there. And so this is a yet.
So
Moscow is obviously threatening to do such a deployment, offering to do it as a part of a joint operation with the United States and Arab nations and Western other nations and Turkey against ISIS, or do it unilaterally.
But how much of this is based upon the fact that the Assad regime is collapsing? At least it can't. It's running out of...
Oh, yes, that's part of it, because we don't want him to collapse.
Right.
It's very important to move to secure the Assad regime further survival, and maybe actually find a way to what Moscow always wanted to. We always wanted to kind of divide the world, sit down with a map, the United States, especially with the United States, and divide the globe into spheres of influence. And Russia is ready to cooperate against the ISIS, okay, but Assad should stay, but Ukraine should be kind of in Russian sphere of influence, and the West should not intervene and not impose sanctions when we are policing Ukraine and imposing our vision of how Ukraine should exist.
But is there...
So this could be a very serious attempt to use the Salafite ISIS threat to finally find a kind of quid pro quo, maybe even a global quid pro quo with Washington.
But do you think that there's any flexibility on Russia's side? There's some hint that there may be flexibility on the Iranian side. They need to protect the Alawites and the Christians on the one hand, but they could probably sacrifice the Assad family. Do you think Russia would ever be more pragmatic, or are they just going to basically... Are they practicing realpolitik here, where it's just about power plays as opposed to this, you know, obviously the Assads have brought much of this destruction of their own country upon themselves?
Well, apparently for Vladimir Putin, it's important that nothing bad happens to Assad. He has a kind of, previously many times lamented the what happened with Gaddafi, with Saddam Hussein, with Milosevic, and there apparently he believes that if these dictators fell and were killed or died, something of the same can happen to him. It's very important for him that personally dictators are secure.
So it's not a question then of. One of the ironies of Western intervention in the Middle East, starting with George W. Bush's ill-fated Iraq war, is that the United States has been toppling secular dictators who are being replaced by religious regimes, and that's clearly the case in Syria, isn't it? And Russia has its problem in Chechnya, in the Caucasus, with Salafists, and there's no question that Syria has become an extraordinary magnet for jihadis, largely influenced by Saudi Arabian Wahhabi ideology.
Well, yes, that's one of the arguments that Moscow is putting forward, that the Assad people are secular, that they are natural enemies of Salafists and ISIS, and we should not try to topple them or undermine them. We should work all together. And that would be good for everyone.
Well, you know, the United States has spent a lot of money and time training Free Syrian Army fighters. And at this point, the few that they've trained up were recently almost decimated by the al-Nusra Front. And now they're actually in a battle, a small town under siege by ISIS. So ISIS is not just fighting Assad. ISIS is also fighting what little, in terms of American surrogates, there are fighting in Syria.
Well, yes, and that may be seen in Moscow. Today, right now, it's a good time to offer this broad coalition and put some pressure and leak some data of possible unilateral Russian deployments to push the Americans and the American administration to recognize the inevitable and, yes, join forces on Russian terms.
So in terms of Putin himself, though, and you mentioned, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, that the possibility of a military offensive in Ukraine has diminished because of the weather. But in terms of sanctions and Putin's position there, obviously these wars, Crimea and then Ukraine, have been very good for him in terms of his popularity, even though he runs basically, he's almost like the new czar. He's in total control of the country to the point where it's sort of alarming. There's literally nobody else. This is probably the most concentrated power of any leader in the world.
And a lot of there's a lot of cynicism in regard to his motives, that he does a lot of international adventures in order to boost up his situation at home. Is that still in play? Are the sanctions biting at the economy?
Sanctions are biting. There's no way in which Putin will be seriously retreating from positions taken on Ukraine, Crimea, the Donbass. The strategic intention there is to secure not only Crimea, but all of Ukraine as part of the Russian sphere of influence. But apparently a decision was made not to begin any major summer offensive this year. Of course, there were threats coming from the West that this could lead to very additional severe sanctions, crippling sanctions indeed. And so most likely now, through forming a kind of understanding, if not an alliance over Syria, something like that was done with the Syrian chemical weapon problem, kind of working together with the Americans, maybe working more, and that could be used as a leverage to make the West make concessions on Ukraine.
But this is not...
And, of course, also secure Russia still keeping a foothold in Syria, which is more or less right now the last leftover of the once very formidable Soviet influence in the Middle East and presence in the Middle East. Now it's just small parts of Syria where we're still present, and we would want to keep that very much. Though, of course, present-day Russia is not the Soviet Union. We cannot possibly deploy such numbers of combat troops as we once did during the Cold War in Syria.
Well, just in closing, though, there's a concern, obviously, that President Putin is capable of behaving recklessly and his economy is in trouble. You mentioned the sanctions are biting, but oil prices are an all-time low. You don't think this is a possible case of recklessness. This is more calculated in terms of trying to find a way to work with the West in Syria.
Yes, I believe that this is calculated. As far as I know, Putin and his administration always try to calculate their moves. Sometimes the calculations are somewhat wrong. With Ukraine and with Crimea, they're underestimated the Western reaction. They believe that the West would huff and puff and forget about it, like about Abkhazia and the Russian invasion of Georgia in August 2008. But that was a miscalculation. But that doesn't mean they acted without calculation.
I see.
So yes, there's always calculation.
And not necessarily...
Russians were always strong in chess.
Yeah, you play chess and the Americans play poker, right? Well, I thank you very much, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, for joining us here tonight from Moscow.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and from 1994 to 2005... he published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. In 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.